The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 27th, 2016.
Donald, it's good to be with you.
Secretary Clinton said okay, good. I want you to be very happy.
The central question in this election is really what kind of country we want to be and what kind of future we'll build together.
Our jobs are fleeing the country. They're going to Mexico. They're going to many other countries.
I call it trumped up. Trickle down.
I think I did a great job in getting him to produce his birth certificate.
Secretary Clinton.
Join the debate by saying more crazy things.
It's all words. It's all sound bites.
I'm not going to make any excuses.
African Americans, Hispanics are living in hell.
It can't be dismissed that easily.
Somebody who's been very vicious to me, Rosie O'Donnell.
And I think we should talk about that.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. On this program, we like to choose the story or issue we believe most Americans will have some kind of conversation about over the course of each day. Normally, it can be a challenge, but today, that choice is a no-brainer. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the first presidential debate at Hofstra University on Long Island spent 100 minutes channeling the great divide in the American electorate. It was a study in contrast that I think has no precedent in modern political history. You can decide for yourself. The debate, moderated by Lester Holt of NBC News, officially asked the candidates about achieving prosperity, securing America, and America's direction. But this first side-by-side showcase from Trump and Clinton was about a whole lot more. Joining us is Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Your impressions, Todd?
Well, I think the amazing thing about this debate is the first time you see these two candidates in contrast, right? You've seen Donald Trump in more than a dozen, I don't know, maybe 18 debates over the course of his primary. I don't know if it was 18. And you've seen Hillary Clinton debate Bernie Sanders so many times in this cycle and so many times in the past when you were watching all the various campaigns that she's been in. But nothing distills the choice, right, capital C, than getting the two people on the stage together, because the contrast, not only on television and in style, but in the split screen and in the way the two candidates present themselves is so very important. And John, your impression that this is unprecedented in so many ways comes into stark relief, because for many voters, I think it's difficult to distill the contrast between the two vastly different styles and vastly different things going on in this campaign until you see them side to side. One candidate, Hillary Clinton, who is flawed, been around for a long time, normal politician, elected to this, elected to that. You know her, you like her, you don't like her. Very over the plate in terms of American politics. And another candidate who's so far not only outside the lines, but whose campaign has been aberrant in so many ways when it comes to American political and cultural norms, that when those two things get together, there's just no getting around that this is not a normal campaign.
I mean, one of the difficulties about talking about this debate is the contrast in language. I mean, we're used to candidates playing fast and loose with the facts, exaggerating, making promises that they can't keep. But in this particular case, you had one candidate speaking like a regular politician, but in complete sentences and with a cadence that's very familiar in American politics. And you had another candidate. I mean, in journalism, you have to be careful when you speak. You can't say things like thousands and thousands of companies are leaving America. Thousands and thousands. I mean, it's thousands and thousands. And that kind of refrain over and over from Donald Trump, I think, was a real contrast. You can't really fact check that. I mean, he talked about Carrier air conditioning moving from Indiana to Mexico, but then he kept saying thousands and thousands more. You can't really fact check that. It's a form of political speech that we haven't really heard before.
That's true. And it's a form of political speech that has benefited Donald Trump greatly.
Yeah, that's true.
People like you, John, and like me, a lot of journalists who are like, well, you fact check this stuff and nobody cares. There's this frustrated cliche refrain in political journalism now, which is called nothing matters. Nothing matters anymore. It doesn't matter how crazy the claim is. The fact checks don't stick. Now, here's, I think, the main—
To quote Trump, it's a beautiful thing, Todd Zwillig. It's a beautiful thing.
And here's the main point behind how that affects things. That has worked for Donald Trump, but he has this ceiling, right? 42%. This is an audience you saw last night, Super Bowl-sized audiences. And of course, this race is about the undecideds and moderate Republicans, independents in places like Pennsylvania and Colorado, Donald Trump's only path to victory, who are uncomfortable with Donald Trump. The gang at the rallies and the gang who are on the Trump train are pro-Trump. Nothing he says is going to get them off of it. And Hillary's hardcore supporters, same goes, despite all of the fact-checking frustrations that all of us have with this rhetorical nonsense that we hear so often. But again, in the primetime contrast of these two candidates, that becomes more and more difficult. And so in this case, you saw it last night. Now, how much does this affect the rest of the race in the debates? That's an open question. I think the answer might be negligible. The history of how much debate performances actually tip elections shows that they don't count for much.
A great moment that illustrates exactly what you're saying is this exchange, which actually goes back to 1964 and the way in which LBJ demolished Barry Goldwater. This is the way they're talking about the nuclear trigger. In a sense, it lands like a sort of comedy moment. It's not a real issue, even though the stakes couldn't be higher. Listen to this.
So a man who can be provoked by a tweet should not have his fingers anywhere near the nuclear codes, as far as I think anyone with any sense about this should be concerned.
That line's getting a little bit old, I must say. Listen,
it's a good one, though.
I would like to.
Well, describes the problem.
It's not an accurate one at all. It's not an accurate one. So I just want to give a lot of things and just to respond. I agree with her on one thing. The single greatest problem the world has is nuclear armament, nuclear weapons.
Right. Nothing could be more grave in a presidential debate. Yeah. There was also a question on nuclear first use, which is right. Not just a question of whether you decide to nuke the Russians first. There's an entire military doctrine underlying that Donald Trump didn't quite seem to be aware of. And let me follow that on one other Donald Trump statement on very serious national security issues that I think a lot of people took notice of.
I have a son. He's 10 years old. He has computers. He is so good with these computers. It's unbelievable. The security aspect of cyber is very, very tough, and maybe it's hardly doable. But I will say we are not doing the job we should be doing. But that's true throughout our whole governmental society.
So it sounds like a cut you pulled out of context, but it's not.
No, this is for anything else, whether you think this is a good answer or not, this is the mark of a candidate who was unprepared to answer this question. He may not care to be prepared for it, but on the issues of cybersecurity and what needs to be done to counter Russian and Chinese hacking, I mean, this is a nonsensical answer.
To be fair, I think that there was a substantive exchange on trade, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
His best moments on were on trade.
Moment,
absolutely.
Exactly.
He should repeat those.
And Hillary Clinton did not really have an answer about how she's flip-flopped on TPP, and Trump was able to claim it was because of him. I also thought the way both candidates confronted or failed to really confront Lester Holt's very good questions about race and law enforcement was very telling, and we'll see where that goes in the next debate.
Yeah, I think it was too. I think the fact that Donald Trump in this debate failed to speak in a sensitive or meaningful way about race to me wasn't surprising. Frankly, his strategy throughout this campaign at the times he does talk about race has been largely talking over the heads of people of color, particularly in this case, black folks and Latino voters, Hispanic voters, to normalize his campaign with white voters who are uncomfortable with the Donald Trump phenomenon, you know, white nationalists and stuff like that. People I think of as in the Pennsylvania suburbs. So that to me wasn't surprising.
And here he is deflecting.
But just like she can't bring back jobs, she can't produce.
I'm sorry, I'm just going to follow up, and I will let you respond to that because if there's a lot there. But we're talking about racial healing in this segment. What do you say to Americans?
Well, it was very – I say nothing because I was able to get him to produce it. He should have produced it a long time before.
He's talking about the birther issue there. So, but again,
I say nothing.
I say nothing to them. No backtracking, no contrition on the birther issue, the racist lie that he spread across this country for 6 years.
Normally, the headline in all the papers would be, I paid no taxes, right? We learned that last night.
Yeah. Well, sort of acknowledging that he might not have, or that if he had, it might have gone to use. I do want to say one thing about Hillary's answers on race. They were much more complete.
True.
She talked about policing. She talked about criminal justice reform. She talked about unfair treatment for African-American males. But Hillary's answers on race race, I was a little surprised, John. They were extremely cautious, given how strong her support is in this community and how much she needs massive African-American turnout in places like Philadelphia and other cities in order to swamp Trump. It was a passionless set of answers. It was extremely cautious. And it was an opportunity, I thought, for Hillary Clinton to express a real connection with the wants and needs and anxieties of African-American and Latino voters, in this case, African-Americans, that she might have missed.
And the Trump omissions here, nothing about the Clinton Foundation, nothing really about extent to which the emails could have been a national security crisis.
He hit her on it.
Asked about, but it was not. It was not really elaborated on, and that's what people are going to be talking about all day today. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, you'll be back for the next debate, right?
We will be back for the next debate and for the three that are remaining.
Thanks so much.
You got it.
The role of NATO was a part of the candidate debate last night.
But when you look at NATO, I was asked on a major show, what do you think of NATO? Now, you have to understand, I'm a business person. I did really well, but I have common sense. And I said, well, I'll tell you, I haven't given lots of thought to NATO.
NATO, as a military alliance, has something called Article 5. And basically, it says this: an attack on one is an attack on all. And do you know the only time it's ever been invoked? After 9/11.
Is the U.S. getting a raw deal from its NATO allies? Anders Fogh Rasmussen, 2-1. Is the U.S. getting a raw deal from its NATO allies? Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO from 2009 until 2014, and before that, the Danish Prime Minister, says NATO has been unfairly bashed in the 2016 election. But he also believes that NATO allies need to restore U.S. power and leadership in the world, something that has been lost over the past 8 years. In a new book, The Will to Lead, America's Indispensable Role in the Global Fight for Freedom, Rasmussen says despite the Obama years' mistakes in the Middle East and elsewhere, the U.S. is still the world's 5,000-pound gorilla and has responsibilities whether we like it or not.
I wouldn't say that the United States hasn't made any mistakes, but you could also ask who else than the United States should act as what I call the world's policeman. We need clearly a policeman. When you have a look at Syria, Iraq, Libya, China flexing its muscles, the rogue state, North Korea, we need a policeman to restore law and order in the world. And I don't see any other than the United States. The United States is the only nation capable and credible as the world's policeman.
How important is this election, do you think?
I really do believe that's a crucial election for the world. After 8 years where the United States has demonstrated a reluctance to engage in the world, we need the next president to really take global leadership in leading the free democracies and counter autocracy and terrorists.
In terms of world leaders, Vladimir Putin, in your tenure as Secretary General of NATO, really pulled a fast one, it seems like, that he charmed George W. Bush and conveyed even to you, frankly, that you describe in your book, a sense of friendship and that Russia wants to be a part of this new world order. And then he seems to have really shafted all of you at the last minute. How do you feel about all that?
When I first met President Putin in May 2002 as new Prime Minister of Denmark, I saw a very pro-Western Russian president. So I left that summit very optimistic. Then suddenly things changed. And from 2005, we saw a very negative President Putin. He's been worse ever since. And you might ask why. And I see two reasons. One was the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2003. The next was the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004. President Putin was strongly convinced that the Americans in general and CIA in particular were behind those colored revolutions and that the aim was to spread that to Moscow. And since then, he has been increasingly anti-Western. So he is an embodiment that when the United States retreats, or even is perceived to retreat, the United States will leave behind a vacuum, and that vacuum will be filled by the bad guys.
There's a lot of skepticism about the United States right now. If you go to Estonia or Latvia, there's a certain sort of musing about whether the U.S. would actually defend a Russian invasion of the Baltic states. If there's that doubt, how does the U.S. prevent one of these places from basically changing the map of the world?
That's a very good question. And I think one of the most damaging statements from the current administration is the statement that was presented by an anonymous source that the U.S. was leading from behind. I've never heard the president nor his secretaries use that expression, but nevertheless, it was stated that the U.S. would only lead from behind, which, of course, is, that's ridiculous. You cannot lead from behind. You'll have to lead from the front. And furthermore, one of the presidential candidates, Mr. Trump, has raised doubts about collective defense within NATO because he has stated that he would make that defense dependent on the country's contributions.
Well, he said NATO is obsolete. He said it's obsolete.
Yeah, so all that together has raised doubts about the U.S. commitment to defending its allies. So all in all, we need the next president to really demonstrate, like President Kennedy once did when in his inaugural he stated that the U.S. will pay any price, bear any burden to defend friends and promote liberty.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen served as Secretary General of NATO from 2009 till 2014. He's the author of The Will to Lead, America's Indispensable Role in the Global Fight for Freedom.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Wait a minute. We were essentially denied our constitutional right to a fair trial.
We can give at least some measure of peace to their families who've lost so much.
What prevented the attorney from doing that in this case was the judge.
Whether or not a case can continue to be heard in a court really is a matter of state law.
The police records, the prosecutorial records from this case have never been turned over to the defense.
The truth needs to be told.
We've been fascinated by a feature of the Marshall Project's exploration of the criminal justice system in America. Andrew Cohen periodically writes a commentary called Case in Point, one case highlighting one aspect of the justice system. Today, it's the story of Nathaniel Epps and his brother-in-law, Persil Warren. Both are dead, but the issues in their cases are very much alive. They were convicted in 1996 of raping a Norfolk, Virginia woman. In 2012, Persil Warren died of cancer in prison, just a year before advanced DNA testing could have exonerated him. And Nathaniel Epps passed away earlier this month, a week after being diagnosed with liver cancer and several years into fighting what his lawyers believe was a wrongful conviction. The Marshall Project's Andrew Cohen spoke to us about this case, which involves the impact of new DNA technology developed after these men were convicted. And equally important, says Innocence Project staff attorney Olga Axelrod, is the availability of proper health care to keep inmates alive long enough to benefit from this kind of new DNA evidence.
There have been cases where people were exonerated after their death in a court of law. That occurred in Texas in the Timothy Cole case. It occurred in the Frankly Smith case in Florida. Certainly from our perspective, it's very important to continue the fight to clear Mr. Epps and Mr. Warren. We feel very strongly that the DNA here is powerful evidence of the innocence of both of these men. And we can't give them back the years that they lost. We can't give them back their freedom now. But we can give them back their good names. We can give them back their reputation. We can give at least some measure of peace to their families who've lost so much.
Is that principle such a big deal that you can't really render something like this moot, even though some people might view this as an administrative waste of time since the defendants are both gone?
The law generally, judges generally, are very receptive to mootness arguments in situations like this. There wasn't a recantation by any of the witnesses, you know, there wasn't a confession by some other perpetrator stepping forward. It isn't as clear cut as some of the other cases we've seen like this. On the other hand, there are still now profound questions about the validity, the accuracy, the reliability of the convictions here. One of the things I wrote about in the piece that I think is very important that shouldn't be forgotten is the notion that post-conviction, the records, the police records, the prosecutorial records from this case have never been turned over to the defense. Now, they may buttress the prosecution's theory, they may be nothing, or they may show something that actually supports the theories that this new DNA evidence seems to support. And if that's the case, you get even a bigger story or bigger angle to this story. So I think there are issues that need to be explored, but I think the judges tend to, in these sorts of situations, say, you know what, I have enough on my plate. I'm going to go in a different direction.
Olga, if a judge says to you, you know, we have a lot of cases on the docket here. We've got a lot of serious stuff that we're dealing with here. We really can't be concerned with this case that's academic at best and moot at worst. What's your argument?
Well, my argument would be that the DNA here proves that a wrongful conviction occurred, and the truth needs to be told. Whether or not the defendants have passed, they still have families who have, you know, a real interest in having the truth spoken.
And there's a rapist out there.
Absolutely. Justice was not done for anyone in this case. It wasn't done for the defendants, and it wasn't done for the victim.
Olga Axelrod is senior staff attorney for the Innocence Project, and Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, a biweekly column which sheds a light on a single case or character from the criminal justice system. Thanks to both of you for a fascinating discussion.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Officer who beat my brother. Is he here?
At the foot of the bridge to the Rikers Island Jail in Queens, New York this past Saturday, Akeem Browder, the brother of Khalif Browder, turned his back on the crowd he was speaking to and addressed the many police officers that were standing guard.
This is the Department of Corrections. It's corrupt. They dehumanize our brothers at a pay rate of 38 an hour.
Khalif Browder was wrongfully arrested at the age of 16, spent 3 years awaiting trial at Rikers Island Jail, two of those in solitary confinement, and ended up committing suicide after his release in June 2015. A child, damaged beyond reach by a criminal justice system that processes the mistakes and overreaches of prosecutors, warehouses the delays of lawyers and judges, and in the Browder case, left a teenager to grow up in New York City's largest and most controversial jail. A rally of people who want prison reform and who especially want Rikers to close held a march and shared their stories.
The first time I was on Rikers Island, I was almost raped.
Lavelle Pointer is 48. He's been on Rikers twice, most recently for an accused drug sale.
I had the tendons in my hand cut. I haven't had ribs broken.
U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara calls stories like that Rikers' culture of violence. Enduring it is not what the criminal justice system had in mind when it created jails like Rikers, and while a judicial sentence eventually comes to an end, the impact of the violence at Rikers Island often does not.
You're working on instincts of survival now. This is the only way to survive. This is the only way I'm going to get to talk to my children is if I bust somebody in the head. And so by the time you go through a year, 2 years of that, it's like an indoctrination period that changes you from a normal person to this, I hate to say it, but like this real animal. It's like going to war, like coming back home from Vietnam. You're totally screwed. When I came home, I didn't know. I didn't know that, you know, I had post-traumatic stress disorder. I didn't know that for years. Finally, I get diagnosed, and it makes sense to me. And I didn't even realize how much my mentality had changed. Like, Rikers Island is a place that manufactures criminal mentality. And when we're going into these places, it's just killing us.
New York City and state have enacted a series of reforms. There are new surveillance cameras, reducing the use of solitary confinement, adding hundreds of new officers with body cameras. The federal government is now a Rikers watchdog. And monitors issued a report in May saying there do seem to be some improvements, noting a drop of 17% of assaults on staff.
I mean, the changes have been made. There have been changes made, but I don't know how much better it is. We're still hearing those stories. We're still hearing those abuses, still hearing about the sexual assaults on sexual violence against women. And if it is, in fact, not improving after all the quote-unquote change that's taken place, then maybe the best thing to do is just close it down. It's too broken. It's too sick.
Paul Prestia is a lawyer for Khalif Browder's family in their case against the city of New York. He also represents Candy Haley. Like Browder, Haley spent 3 years at Rikers in pretrial detention, only to be found not guilty. Most of her time was spent in solitary confinement, where she attempted to commit suicide 8 times. Prestia says that the confinement, delays, and permanent wounds experienced by his clients go well beyond denial of due process and a speedy trial as guaranteed by the Constitution.
37 months in solitary confinement, 80 suicide attempts. She's still alive, and I'm making sure that she stays alive. And you will hear her story soon enough.
Oh, my name is Candy, and I came out today because I'm a solitary survivor. It's amazing I'm still here. Sometimes I don't believe I'm still here.
Haley is in her early 30s now. In a suicide note in 2014, she noted, "I can't endure this abuse evermore. The truth will come to light while death shall set me free." She's currently facing a felony charge for criminal mischief for breaking a chair in jail. But she's now been diagnosed with a number of mental illnesses, all made worse by Rikers.
I had memories every day. I can't just using the lavatory is a problem because I had to hold my urine for so many hours being in solitary confinement that I damaged my uterus. And not only that, even a bottle of water brings back memories because I was denied water for so long. Even taking a shower brings back memories because I was just denied a shower so long. I would be in there for days without a shower, days without recreation, days without, months without contact with the outside world. So sometimes I feel nervous being around crowds. I feel nervous being around officers. And I was very nervous about coming here today because it's so close to Rikers. I was just afraid I was going to get arrested again or beat in front of everybody.
Candy Haley is not alone to have as her treatment for severe mental illness being warehoused at Rikers Island. Today there doesn't appear to be much of a way back to normal for Rikers inmates like her or who are like Khalif Browder, who's dead. Candy says she can still see her former self off in the distance.
The Candy before was outgoing, outspoken, fun, loving. Now the Candy now is I like to be inside. I don't like coming outdoors. I don't like speaking. I don't like crowds. But I know that Khalif Browder lives inside of me, and I'm fighting to tell his testimony as well. So I can't be selfish. I have to tell his story, and I have to tell my story.
Aggressive reform is now the policy for corrections authorities in New York, but the consensus among these former inmates at this rally and demonstration in Queens, witnessed by our Takeaway producer Oliver Lazarus, is that Rikers Island should be closed down. Governor Andrew Cuomo actually supports that, although New York's mayor and other skeptics say closing Rikers is a political pipe dream that would take decades and cost billions.
Trust. You are now on the inside of what I like to call circle of trust.
You want me to trust you? Don't use big words you don't understand.
News consumers have gone into their corners.
It's time for who do you trust? Hubba, hubba, hubba. Money, money, money. Who do you trust?
What we have to begin to do is look to ourselves.
I've given up wine and trusting.
Trust in me.
Americans may be leery of their political options in 2016 and full of anxiety about the state of play in the presidential election after last night's debate. But we have to trust somebody. Our series, Got Trust? Exploring Faith and Suspicion in the 21st Century, today looks at the U.S. military. According to a June Gallup poll, more Americans trust the military than any other institution in the U.S.
73% of us said that we either had a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the military. No other institution in American life even comes close. For instance, 9% say they feel similarly about Congress. Even after trillions of dollars of taxpayers' money spent and misspent on misguided wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the weapons of mass destruction that weren't in Iraq, Americans still hold dear the men and women who wear the uniforms and perform the missions on behalf of a flawed civilian political system. Retired Colonel Andrew Basevich is the author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. He says, sadly, that America's trust for the men and women in uniform has meant a blank check for the White House and Congress to deploy those men and women all over the world.
So many of our national institutions have been found wanting in that regard, whether we're talking about the Congress or we're talking about churches. And I sense that Americans are desperate to find some large institution where people seem to get up in the morning and do the job that they were hired to do and do it in the right way. And the military has become that institution in our culture.
Do soldiers operate on the basis of trust of each other in a squad, in a command structure?
There's a great deal of historical evidence that those bonds of trust are enhanced the closer you get to being in harm's way. That said, as with any institution, things are more complex than they may appear to outsiders. If there's trust and confidence within the military, there's also a great deal of cutthroat competition because it is a hierarchical institution and its members, particularly in the officer corps, yes, they sign up to serve, but they also sign up to see how far they can get in that hierarchy. So there is competition along with trust.
Do you think the political sphere of American government abuses the trust that the public has for the military by asking them to do things that they aren't capable of or sending them into missions that they aren't committed to or that they have no willingness to invest in the end game?
No question about it. I mean, I have come to believe that it is nothing short of a scandal that political authorities devote so little attention to examining the wars that we have been involved in, particularly in the greater Middle East over the past couple of decades. There's no accountability. There's no examination of what has occurred or of what's likely to come next. There's no clear understanding of what victory would even look like. And so we have a series of campaigns that simply continue to unfold one after another. And it has become such an open-ended enterprise that I think that really is an indictment. And it's an indictment that should be at the feet of our political leaders, much more so than the military itself.
Where do you think trust is eroding, either within the military or the military's perception of the civilian, political sphere?
I don't have enough sense of what's going on within the officer corps right now to really give you a good answer to that question. I mean, I could speculate and frankly, I would hope that there is a growing awareness within the officer corps that this enterprise that we're engaged in, whether we call it the war on terror or whatever, isn't going well, has become to some degree mindless and counterproductive. And to the extent that there is that growing awareness, that capacity to think critically within the officer corps, that could well translate into a lack of trust or a lessening of trust that officers have in the political leaders that send them to go do what they're sent to do.
The military seems to embody both this intensive person-to-person trust and also this trust from admiration that comes from the public at large.
Part of the allure of life in the military that many civilians can't appreciate, and that's okay, but it is to become part of an enterprise that is based on a sense of common purpose, of collective purpose. Those concepts, I think, are tending to become harder and harder to find in American life, but they do survive within the military.
So much talk in the political sphere is about, can we trust each other in communities? Can we find that common ground to deal with racial issues? Can we create a sense of bipartisanship and mutual trust to solve serious problems of infrastructure and other things that we face in the United States that are certainly going to be challenges over the next couple of decades? What lessons from the military, short of everybody putting on a uniform, do you think we need to learn?
The place to begin is with a broadly shared understanding of collective purpose. When I was a cadet at West Point, long, long, long ago, the phrase that was drummed into us was the motto of the military academy, duty, honor, and country. And of course, to some degree, that's just a phrase. It's just a few words. But the environment within the military academy itself, this place that we live together for a period of 4 years, made that phrase something much more than words. It ended up translating into a code, a set of values. And it seems to me if we're going to have any sort of trust in society at large, there has to be that shared understanding of basic values, and it doesn't exist in America today. I mean, at one level, we would all say, as Americans, we believe in freedom. But ask any collection of Americans, what do you mean by freedom? You're going to get a whole bunch of different answers. And I think that the absence of a common understanding of the core values defining our society, that creates barriers to the sort of trust and confidence that at least to some degree exists in the military today.
Andrew Bacevich, retired colonel in the U.S. Army and professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University, is the author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
A very thoughtful Andrew Bacevich. With this installment of our series on trust, you can hear the whole series on trust at thetakeaway.org/trust. More to come this week. By the way, the polls are open, folks. Early voting for 2016 in a number of states has begun as of yesterday. About 10,000 people have voted in the reporting states and localities. 10,000 votes. You don't know the breakdown, but there are about 110,990,000 votes to go between now and November 8th. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.